Hello, it is Friday, July 3rd. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The government and major companies unveiled a 312 trillion won investment plan to develop the Gyeongsang region into a high-tech industrial hub, with the president outlining visions for semiconductors and aerospace in the region. More on that shortly. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we will talk about the Korea Composite Stock Price Index's continued volatility and South Korea's failure to make it to the MSCI's Developed Markets Watch List. And finally, we look at the Korean film The Second Child and the Buncheon International Fantastic Film Festival. Korea 24 starts now. The government and major companies, including SK, Samsung, Hanwha, and Hyundai Motor Group, unveiled a 312 trillion won plan to develop the Gyeongsang region into a high-tech hub for next-generation semiconductors and advanced materials, with President Lee Jae-myung presiding over this briefing in the southeastern city of Jinju. To give us the details of the government's push to vitalize the regional economy, as well as some of the other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Andrew.
The president made the remarks on Friday at the latest of its series of national briefings on advanced industry development for the region, saying the government and businesses will work together to strengthen it as a core center of next generation industries. What did he say?
Well, in the briefing in the southeastern city of Jinju, he said large scale investment will be made in next generation semiconductors, AI data centers, robotics, the automotive industry, shipbuilding and physical AI to transform manufacturing into an intelligent industry. In particular, he singled out space development, adding that it will become a new growth engine for the Gyeongsang region, with plans to build a southern coastal aerospace industry belt linking satellites, launch vehicles, and future aircraft industries.
And as part of that project, South Korea's leading defense and aerospace company, Hanwha Group, has announced plans to invest 55 trillion won, or $35.6 billion, in the space and artificial intelligence sectors to build an integrated space infrastructure centered on the Gyeongsang region. Hee-jin, can you elaborate on these plans?
Well, Hanwha Group Vice Chairman Kim Dong-kwan was on hand at the public briefing on Friday to present the company's plans to develop an independent launch vehicle, a satellite network, and a defense AI system to support military operations. Under the plan, Hanwha Aerospace will invest 23 trillion won in launch vehicle development, while Hanwha Systems will spend around 20 trillion one on low Earth orbit satellites, a space-based AI data center, and satellite communications. Hanwha also plans to invest more than 10 trillion won in defense AI, building a defense AI center in Changwon.
Meanwhile, the presidential office announced that Lee will attend a NATO summit in Turkey next week, followed by a state visit to Mongolia. Hee-jin, can you give us the details of his overseas itinerary?
Of course. National Security Advisor Wi Sung-nak briefed reporters on the president's overseas itinerary at the presidential office of Cheongwadae on Friday, saying he will first attend the summit in Ankara on Tuesday and Wednesday at the invitation of NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. We explained that Lee's participation in the NATO summit is part of South Korea's efforts to enhance defense industry cooperation with NATO allies, which collectively account for approximately 55% of global defense spending and represent the world's largest defense market. The president will then travel to the Mongolian capital of Ulaanbaatar for a state visit from Thursday to Saturday, where he will hold a summit with Mongolian President Kurilesh Ukana. The two leaders are expected to declare a golden era of South Korea-Mongolia relations and outline a shared vision for the future of bilateral ties.
Turning our attention to domestic issues, the special counsel team investigating former President Yoon Suk-yeol's 2024 martial law attempt has indicted Kim Myung-soo, the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for his alleged involvement. Hee-jin, can you tell us more about this indictment?
Well, the special counsel team led by Hwon Chang-yong indicted Kim late Thursday without detention, asserting that he played a key role in the martial law declaration on the 3rd of December 2024 while serving as the nation's highest-ranking military officer. Investigators believe that Kim took no action as martial law troops moved into the National Assembly and helped establish a martial law command. These counsel team claims Kim was aware that the martial law declaration and troop deployment were unlawful, yet failed to act appropriately in his role as the nation's top military officer. It said Kim's aides warned him multiple times that the declaration was procedurally flawed and that troops should be withdrawn from the National Assembly. However, Kim's legal representatives have rejected these allegations, arguing that then-Defense Minister Kim Yong-hyun took control of the martial law troops after Yun issued his declaration, and Kim Yong-soo was sidelined from the decision-making process.
The Seoul Bankruptcy Court has decided to end the rehabilitation proceedings for HomePlus after the retail chain failed to secure the required funding of 200 billion won, or about 130 million U.S. dollars. What's next for the troubled discount store chain?
Well, the court reached its decision on Friday, saying sales have dropped as the company maintained operations without pursuing merger or acquisition deals for most of its businesses amid sharp increases in public interest claims over wages, payments of goods and taxes. HomePlus has only managed to sell off its HomePlus Express supermarket division to Harim Group affiliate NS Shopping. The court concluded that the company would likely be unable to execute the revised rehabilitation plan it submitted on Tuesday, as it had yet to secure the minimum required funding of 200 billion won. HomePlus can appeal the decision within 14 days, but otherwise the termination will be finalized and ultimately lead to its bankruptcy.
In other news, the top office is pushing back against a U.S. congressional report accusing South Korea of discriminating against Coupang, with an investigation into a major data breach. This comes a day after the White House said that the U.S.-based e-commerce giant is being, quote, singled out by the South Korean government and that it is deeply concerned about what it calls Seoul's, quote, discriminatory targeting of U.S. technology companies. How did South Korea's Chungwade respond?
Well, National Security Advisor Wi Song-nak said Friday during a briefing that South Korea does not single out companies or discriminate based on nationality, denying the report's claims. Wi's remarks followed a report released this week by the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, which accused Seoul of discriminatory attacks against Coupang, after which a White House official made similar comments saying Coupang was being singled out by the Lee Jae-myung administration. The report followed a government investigation into Coupang's data leak that exposed information on more than 33 million customers. We said the claims of discrimination and unfair targeting are not true and that the report relied heavily on Coupang's account while failing to reflect the South Korean government's position. He said the South Korean authorities have handled the case fairly according to domestic law. The exchange marked the latest in a series of back-and-forth remarks between Seoul and Washington amid concerns that Coupang's lobbying in Washington could add further strain to bilateral relations.
In other news, the fallout continues from the Starbucks controversy alleging insult and defamation on the anniversary of the Gwangju Uprising of 1980, this time in high school baseball, stemming from a match between Seoul's Baejae High School and Gwangju's Jaeil High School. What happened?
Well, Baejae High School's baseball team, as well as parents and faculty, will visit Gwangju Jaeil High School next week to apologize for chants that sparked controversy earlier this week, leading to debates online and even at the National Assembly. The Seoul Metropolitan Office of Education held a briefing to disclose that an 80-member delegation comprising Baejae's baseball team and many of the players, parents and teachers will first visit with members of the Gwangju-based high school baseball team and coaching staff at 3 p.m. Monday to apologize for the baseball players' chants, which seemed to mock the 1980 May 18th democratization movement.
It all started, of course, at the Chungnyonggi National High School Baseball Championship match held in Seoul on Monday. Several Paejae High School team members in the dugout shouted, quote, "Let's go to Starbucks," and again, quote, "Tank Day." What did those chants mean?
Well, the chants were in reference to a controversial promotion by Starbucks Korea on the 18th of May, the anniversary of the said Gwangju pro-democracy uprising in 1980. Hundreds of people in Gwangju, many of them students, were killed or injured when the military regime under the former president Chun Doo-hwan deployed tanks and helicopters to suppress pro-democracy protesters. Following Monday's baseball game, Gwangju Jail High School immediately filed a formal protest.
The Korea Baseball Softball Association's Ethics Committee ultimately banned the team from competition for 6 months, effective immediately.
Indeed, the decision prompted a group of Paejae alumni to plead with the Baseball Association to show leniency on Friday. The alumni apologized for the young athletes' behavior while arguing that the athletes deserve the opportunity to learn from their mistakes. The issue has also sparked heated debate at the National Assembly, with the ruling Democratic Party slamming the Paejae students and faculty, and the opposition People Power Party arguing that the students require instruction rather than punishment.
And that's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Heejin.
Thank you.
On Friday, South Korea's Bourse operator activated a buy-side sidecar for the benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index as the index rose sharply following the previous day's heavy sell-off. It marks the 31st sidecar of the year. A buy-side sidecar is activated when the KOSPI 200 futures rise by at least 5% from the previous session's close and remain in that position for 1 minute. The KOSPI closed back above the 8,000 level today after plunging nearly 8% on Thursday. These fluctuations come after the index closed above the 9,000-point threshold for the first time on June 18th. Meanwhile, the country has again fallen short of making global index provider MSCI's watch list of, quote, developed markets this year, an important step to securing developed market status. To listen to the expert opinions on these issues, we have two guests joining us on the line. First, we have Rajiv Biswas, the CEO of Asia Pacific Economics. Hello, Mr. Biswas.
Hello, and thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you for joining us. We also have senior economist Gary Ng from Natixis Corporate Investment Banking. Hello, Mr. Ng.
Hello, it's my pleasure to be here today.
Thank you for joining us as well. Straight to the information that we're going to be talking about today. The KOSPI has been wildly volatile in recent weeks, with circuit breakers triggered 3 times in June, setting a new monthly record. A circuit breaker is activated when the index tumbles by more than 8% from the previous session and stays there for a minute. And the fluctuations, of course, is continuing in July. Mr. Ng, first off, how do you interpret the KOSPI's latest bout of volatility, and what could be behind it?
Well, I guess to answer this question, we need to first look at the broad market trend. And having increased more than 100% at the peak this year and 76% last year for KOSPI, the market view on AI has actually changed a bit. So what has not changed is the ongoing confidence on the AI growth prospect. The pricing power of chip makers remain to be quite strong. However, what has also changed is that the market start to think a little bit more about risk. So there is now a macro repricing on a potential Fed rate hike and inflation risk. KOSPI is also amplified by this large amount of retail investors, leverage products, margin borrowing, and tied to firms like SK Hynix. So all of these are really the reasons behind why the KOSPI has been more volatile than before.
So a lot going on there. Mr. Biswas, South Korea has been, of course, one of the world's best performing stock markets this year. It's been fueled by a surge in semiconductor and AI-related shares, as Mr. Ng just described. What's your take on the recent volatility of the KOSPI, and how long do you think this will last?
Well, I think the global AI industrial revolution has really been driving up semiconductor shares in key technology markets, of course, also in the U.S. and in Taiwan, and then South Korea is part of that big picture story about the AI industrial revolution, and particularly the KOSPI has been driven up by surging prices for Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, which are the large cap semiconductors manufacturers in South Korea. And so we've seen this spectacular rise in the KOSPI over the last 12 months. And of course, when you do have such strong runs, these are more vulnerable to setbacks as well. And we, of course, have seen some pretty dramatic volatility as I think the global run-up in semiconductors shares has seen a pullback in recent weeks. But I think fundamentals are still very favorable for the leading chip makers in South Korea, in Taiwan, and also in the U.S., because the AI supercycle is expected to continue over the medium term. There's a major global transformation in the structure of the economy towards, AI chips, which are needed in all kinds of electronics. And in particular, I think the growing demand for electric vehicles, for robotics, are all helping to increase the demand for these chips. And of course, AI data centers are also requiring a lot of the new AI chips. So I think the fundamentals are still good for strong earnings growth for chip makers over the medium-term outlook. But of course, when you do have rapid run-ups in share prices in a short time frame, there is the risk that any negative news can create significant market volatility. And in particular, there is the risk that technological changes would change the competitiveness of various chip makers could impact on near-term stock price movements.
So the winds are blowing in the right direction. And South Korea, of course, has been one of the world's best performing stock markets this year, fueled by the surge in semiconductor and AI-related shares that Mr. Biswas has just described. But there are concerns about the durability of semiconductor demand. And if the AI boom will continue, Mr. Biswas just said that it's likely to continue in the medium term. But if it will continue, how long will that medium term be? Mr. Ng, what's your take on this? And how long do you expect strong semiconductor demand to continue?
Well, I would say that over the past 2 years, a lot of the capital has been pouring into this general broad AI concept. And from the demand perspective, definitely AI adoption has increased massively. It's faster than many of the past period in digitalization or even from 3G to 4G. And behind this all hyperscale investment, Asia is definitely a winner with as the AI enabler, especially for South Korea through memory chips and etc. So therefore, I'm still quite confident that the demand of AI will be here and is far from really like a bubble, if some may call it, because there is real demand. And to me, it is really about whether the market is happy with the growth that we will continue to see in corporates in the future. Because if, let's say, profit growth is up 30, 40%, which is still quite a good number, if the market pricing is switched higher, it can still cause a certain disappointment. So to me, I am quite confident on the actual demand, but whether such a growth in corporate profits can actually catch up with the market expectation, this to me is a bigger concern.
We're going to zoom in now on the KOSPI itself. Mr. Ng, what's your outlook for the KOSPI in the coming months? And are you optimistic that it will bounce back above the 9,000 mark soon?
Well, I would say I'm quite cautiously optimistic. And of course, whether it can really go beyond 900 towards a really higher level, it really depends on whether there will be like real earnings from the company financial statement, whether the prices can continue to stay high in terms of the memories and etc. And all of this really the new catalyst that will need for Kospi to actually go up further. But having said that, the more likely scenario here is that we will likely see different noises. Maybe the Fed will have a more dovish stance because of the less inflationary pressure, or maybe the demand continue to be quite strong. At the same time, we also have, you know, news about Meta trying to sell some of the over capacity that it may have encountered. So all of this news flow will pretty much put Kospi within the range. I think it's possible that it can bounce back to the previous peak, but whether it can sustain will need something more.
Mr. Bizwaz, what are the major issues that will affect the Kospi in the coming months? Do you agree with Mr. Ng's assessment, and how high do you expect the Kospi to get by the end of the year?
I think that what we've seen is this huge run-up in the Kospi over the last 12 months has been a story about South Korea's large cap semiconductor stocks, notably Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix. And I think that is an important vulnerability for the South Korean index, because compared to, say, the US, which has also got a huge tech sector and has run up because of tech more than anything, the U.S. tech sector is more diversified. You've got a lot of other types of technology firms in there, NASDAQ, for example. You know, you've got firms like Meta, you've got SpaceX now, you've got Tesla. So it's not all about semiconductors, although semiconductors are very important also in the U.S. So I think that is what creates more vulnerability for South Korea, is if there's a sell-off that's focused more on semiconductors, particularly if there's a technology issue that is perceived by the markets as affecting more one of the South Korean manufacturers, then that creates the risk of sentiment changing, at least in the short term, very quickly. And I think that's because the valuations have risen so dramatically that it doesn't take much bad news to get a big correction. So I see that as the important risk for South Korea's Kospi. It's not so much the broad diversified Kospi index, which is the vulnerability, but it's this high concentration on technology for the run-up that's happened. And I think that creates the risk of at least short-term pullbacks. And the reasons for the pullbacks could be technology, or it could also be a broader sell-off. It's, for example, in US tech, which then translates back to South Korea's tech stocks.
There was another setback in South Korea, which has failed to make the global index provider MSCI's watch list of developed markets this year. The watch list is, of course, a crucial step before a market can be upgraded to developed market status. MSCI said limited convertibility of the Korean won in the offshore currency markets remained a key barrier to reclassification. MSCI, which classifies economies based on economic development, the size and liquidity of their equity markets, and how accessible their markets are to foreign investors, has kept South Korea in the, quote, emerging market group since 1992. Mr. Bizwaz, what did you make of this decision?
Well, the latest MSCI review of countries, and particularly the South Korea decision, I think reflects some specific factors that they have indicated quite clearly. So MSCI has cited concerns about the currency market for the South Korean won, particularly the offshore market, and issues related to trading and settlement. So I think a lot of the reasons are around that as to why they have not made that decision. But to upgrade South Korea to a developed country. But I think there's a lot going on in terms of reforms in South Korea. The Korean government has taken steps to address the concerns that were raised much earlier anyway by MSCI. Notably, President Lee Jae-myung has declared in September 2025 that South Korea will push to achieve developed country status for the MSCI. And that resulted in some important government action in January 2026. The South Korean government released a roadmap as to how they can achieve inclusion in the MSCI Developed Country Index, notably changes to the currency market through establishing 24-hour trading and offshore bond settlement, and also market access issues for foreign investors. So I think a lot is happening to try to get over the line in the relatively near future, even though it didn't happen in the recent review by MSCI.
Mr. Ng, what's your take on South Korea's failure to make the MSCI's developed market watch list?
Well, yeah, I totally agree with the point that the forex policy is definitely one of the drag that stopped Korea from being included in this better market classification. And of course, if you look at the economic fundamentals or the market size, definitely Korea is pretty much quite close to this developed economy definition. And however, of course, it's a long process. It doesn't really come overnight. So I guess eventually when we start to see more reform being put in South Korea, then it is possible to reach it one day. But I wouldn't be too worried about this current setback right now because it is simply just a process that it will need to take for the reform.
So some level of optimism there from both of our experts. Mr. Biswas, South Korea's finance ministry said the country was not added to the watch list this year because some reforms were still underway and completed measures needed more time to show results. The ministry said it would continue pursuing foreign exchange and capital market reforms, adding that inclusion in MSCI's developed market index would follow if the changes continued, according to South Korea's needs and timeline. Mr. Biswas, what measures should the country take to receive that title?
I think the MSCI has already made it quite clear what kind of reforms are required. And the South Korean government has also very much taken note of that and has spent a lot of effort to develop a roadmap to make the necessary changes. So I think that process is already well underway. The South Korean government understands what needs to be done. And so a number of government ministries are working on these reforms and implementing the necessary reforms to the currency market and market accessibility, of course, led by the Ministry of Finance, the Financial Services Commission, Bank of Korea, and of course, including the Korean Stock Exchange as well. So I think there's a tremendous effort underway. And I think what will happen is that MSCI will take some time to review the implementation of all these reforms. So I think markets need to give MSCI a little bit of, you know, time frame to do their necessary reviews. Because from MSCI's point of view, they don't want to keep moving countries up and down in their ranking. So they want the move to be a one-off move upwards and not have to again pull down a country. So from that point of view, MSCI wants to take a cautious approach to its upgrading of South Korea, and the same for any other country as well. That is their approach, which makes sense. On a positive note, It does seem likely that this kind of upgrade for South Korea from MSCI to developed country status will be relatively soon, I would say. And that would, of course, be another positive for the KOSPI. So there's another positive factor that might help the medium-term outlook for the KOSPI, in addition to what we've already discussed about the AI revolution and what it's done for South Korean technology stocks.
Right. I think the general view is that it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when that's going to happen. And if it does happen, the upgrade would help resolve the so-called, quote, Korea discount, a term used to describe the lower valuations often assigned to South Korean stocks compared with global peers. Mr. Ng, what's your take on this assessment and what efforts should South Korea make to be included in MSCI's developed markets category?
Well, I would say this problem of a Korean discount is probably a term that has existed for quite a long time. And then we do see some improvement over these 2 years without even the MSCI label. So it means that the MSCI is not really the only way to solve this problem about the lower valuation. And of course, it also doesn't really solve some of the structural problems that the market may be worried about. For example, the governance among Korean companies, how do they really deliver like the best return to shareholders, or beyond that, also about exchange rate policies and etc. So I still think that the hurdles around the foreign exchange policy will still be the major kind of hurdle that Korea will face in order to become like a developed market within the MSCI index. But at the same time, I would say that Korea is not an economy that only rely on this sort of foreign flows. There's also other type of consideration that need to be seen within the economic policy. For example, if the currency become too volatile after being included in this index because of the laxer regulation, is the price worth it? Because as we see, the won is also quite weak recently, that may prompt some intervention. So I guess all of this basically means that, yeah, it's one of the way, but also not the only way. And some of the latest interesting development would be SK Hynix trying to list in the US as the ADR that could also give the access of foreign investors to Korean names, and can potentially narrow the valuation gap as well. So there are many other things that it can be done. And of course, policymakers will weigh the pros and cons to see what's the best like for the country.
So some potential trade-offs and risks and other measures that could be taken as well. But that's it for today's in-depth news analysis. We had Rajiv Biswas from Asia Pacific Economics. Thank you, Mr. Biswas.
Thank you.
We also had Gary Ng from Natisis Corporate and Investment Banking. Thank you, Mr. Ng.
Thanks very much for having me.
Pianist Kim Se-hyun. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 440.25 points, or 5.76%, on Friday to close at 8,088.34. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 1.69 points, or 0.19%, to close at 868.41. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
What's our first story today?
Over in Incheon, northwest of Seoul, a police officer is under investigation for running over a citizen, and this happened to be the person she was supposed to help.
A tragedy, of course. Is she okay, and what exactly happened?
Well, unfortunately, the victim passed away after being run over. Officials at the Incheon Mutual Police Station said Friday that around 12:45 a.m., the officer in her 20s arrived at the area she was dispatched to after receiving a report that a woman in her 60s had collapsed and was lying on the road, but she ran over the woman with her patrol car.
And what did the police officer say had happened?
Well, the officer said that she did not see the victim. Police said the streets were dark and the accident occurred at a point near a left turn in the road. She was accompanied by a police sergeant who was in the passenger seat, so the sergeant bears no legal responsibility or fault as there was no input or interference while she was driving.
So is the younger officer now facing charges, involuntary manslaughter, perhaps?
Well, she is accused of death resulting from a traffic accident and is being questioned. But further investigation, including analysis of the surveillance footage, will be carried out before a decision is made on the need for an arrest warrant request.
A tragedy both ways. What's our next story, Dan?
After a business owner in Korea shared an anecdote about an employee asking for a day off due to a pet passing away, online communities are abuzz with fierce debate on whether such pet bereavement leave is necessary.
And what are the pet owners saying about the matter?
Well, to this group, losing a companion animal is no different from losing a family member. A study by a financial research institute showed that 64.6% of pet owners who lost their pets held a funeral for them. A study by the College of Veterinary Medicine at Seoul National University found 85% of people who lost their pets experience emotional or psychological changes.
I've lost a pet before, and it really does hurt as much as losing an actual family member. And whether that warrants a bereavement day is perhaps another debate. But what are we hearing from those who oppose providing off days for the pet funerals?
Aside from angry comments opposing the notion that can easily be seen online, where the debate over the matter continues with some arguing where the line should be drawn, as for now it seems to focus on loss of pet dogs or cats, but some wonder if it would extend to include the passing of one's pet goldfish or small animals, perhaps. So looking back in 2022, a legal revision to grant pet owners up to 5 days of leave when their pets fell ill or died was proposed. And it faced strong opposition with roughly 7,700 comments posted on the National Assembly website claiming that the measure would be unfair to people without pets.
As of now, are there employers that offer bereavement leaves for workers who lose their pets?
Well, not a lot, only a handful, but the number is reportedly growing, starting with major foreign firms in Korea that officially offered pet funeral leave back in 2020. The trend caught on with Korean companies that includes major ones like Lotte Department Store. These benefits are offered at the company level and are not mandated by law. Government data shows around 29.2% of households in Korea had pets in 2025. That's the highest figure on record. But workplace benefits are still largely built around marriage, childbirth, and childcare.
Perhaps this debate will continue with more people becoming pet owners in Korea. But now we go to our final story. What do you have, Dan?
The Korea Heritage Service said Friday that it has named K-pop superstar G-Dragon honorary ambassador for the 48th session of the UNESCO World Heritage Committee.
So a lighter story to end our day. What did the agency say about the main reasons for tapping G-Dragon for the role?
Well, the committee said they chose him in recognition of his global influence beyond K-pop and his contributions to culture and the arts. They also highly regarded G-Dragon's efforts to address social issues through art and promote public interest culture. And plus, he is no novice as an ambassador. He did serve that role to perfection at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit held in Gyeongju last year, even performed at the gala dinner.
And what kind of activities will G-Dragon be taking on as the UNESCO World Heritage Committee ambassador?
For this ambassador role, he will support campaigns promoting the protection of World Heritage sites. So some of the activities will include appearing in promotional videos and campaign events to help deliver a message of peace through culture and participation.
And what makes that upcoming event extra special?
So the 40th session is set to be held in Busan from July 19th to 29th, and this marks the first time South Korea is hosting the meeting since joining the World Heritage Convention in 1988. Before that, the foundation will launch the Heritage in Peace campaign with UNESCO on July 10th, encouraging citizens, businesses, and cities to participate in protecting World Heritage Sites. Donations raised through the campaigns goes towards supporting efforts to safeguard heritage sites threatened by war, climate change, and natural disasters.
Good luck to G-Dragon, and the event at Busan sounds like fun. But that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, I pull out my driver. I check my stance and grip. I'm trying to remember every single Nicholas tip. Straighten that left elbow. Slightly bend your knees. Keep your head behind the ball and look out for those trees. Oh, Lord.
Hello, I am golfer. I'm Byung-hun. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
You know I'm lost out in the forest. Save me from those double bogey blues.
It is time now for our Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, where we discuss box office hits and the must-watch indie picks worth your time this weekend. Joining us in the studio again are our movie critics, Darcy Paquette. Hello, Darcy.
Hi, Andrew.
And Jason Bechervais. Jason.
Hello, Andrew.
Today we're going to be doing a little bit different approach to our segment today. We're going to be reviewing one movie the way we usually do, and then we're going to be doing something a little different. We're going to be talking about a film festival instead of a specific movie. But without further ado, let's begin. Darcy, this week you're recommending a Korean independent film that premiered at last year's Busan International Film Festival, which opened in theaters on Wednesday. This film is The Second Child, or in Korean, 그림자 아이. It's a mystery fantasy thriller and focuses on two sisters whose fates seem tied up in a dark fairy tale. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so this is the second film by a director named Yoo Eun-jung, and she made her debut back in 2019 with an independent film called Ghost Walk, or 밤의 문이 열린다. And that film, too, you know, it was kind of hard to pin down in terms of genre. You know, it's a ghost story, but not a horror film. It's kind of more a sad drama. And, you know, this new film is somewhat similar. So at first glance, you might think it's a horror film, you know, from the poster and the imagery. And, you know, a lot about the film kind of strongly evokes the real classic 2003 film, A Tale of Two Sisters by Kim Ji-yoon. Not the least, the actress, Im Soo-jung, who, mm-hmm. you know, kind of launched her career back in 2003 with that film. And she appears as the mother in this film. And she also serves as producer in the film. But yeah, when you actually sit down to watch this new film, like the mood is not at all like a horror film. It's kind of more reflective. It's about grief in some ways. The film's Korean title when it first screened in Busan was 두 번째 아이, or The Second Child, but they since changed it in Korean to 그림자 아이, which means shadow child. And yeah, so they wanted to kind of emphasize a bit the shadow, kind of the fairy tale aspects of the story.
So that was why they changed the name.
It seems that way. You know, I think that in most cases you're kind of rushing to, you know, release a film at a festival and then mm-hmm. you get some response from the audience. You know, The Second Child is maybe, I don't know, I'm just kind of putting words in their mouths here, mm-hmm. but I think maybe they thought that, you know, Shadow Child kind of was more evocative of, mm-hmm. represented the story a bit better. Mm-hmm.
I did see the trailer. I didn't see the movie itself, but it did seem a lot, you know, scary and you know, all that stuff. But
it's not scary.
It's not scary. Tell us a bit more about the story itself and what role the fairy tale plays in the plot.
Yeah, so the film opens with the older sister reading from this picture book to her younger sister, Su-an. And it tells of the shadow that's living in the darkness deep underground. It kind of envies humans, and so it approaches these two sisters and demands that one of them switch places with him so that he can live above ground. And the girls don't want to do it, and he threatens the girls and eventually convinces one of them to give herself up. And, you know, and this idea of like two young girls who cannot continue living unless, you know, one of the two ends up sacrificing herself. That's kind of the idea at the center of the story, mm-hmm. you know, both in a symbolic way, but also in, you know, the family seems to be living under some kind of curse. Mm. And, you know, the fantasy and realistic elements of the film, you know, blend together. You know, when the film kind of properly opens up, the second scene of the film, Su-an wakes up from a 3-year coma and she learns that her sister has thrown herself off the roof and died. She and her mother, who's a therapist, they struggle to adjust to their new life with just the two of them. But then one day, Su-an sees a girl in the street who looks completely identical to her older sister.
So again, this is not supposed to be scary. But tell us a bit more about Im Soo-jung's role in the film, as well as the younger actors.
Mm. I mean, I think the acting is the strong point of the film. Im Soo-jung, you know, as the mother, she's been working in the industry for 2.5 decades. And I think, you know, she's always been kind of a natural for acting, but here I think we feel her experience in the performance as well. You know, she knows just the right amount of emotion to put into it. She doesn't overdo it for a dramatic effect. And I'm really happy that she took part in this film as a producer as well, because mm-hmm. the director said that probably they couldn't have made the film without her help. But yeah, I mean, she's a really important character as the mother, and even if she's not kind of the main eyes through which we see the story. I was really impressed by the young actress, Park Soo-yi, as well. I mean, she's been in a lot of films and TV dramas. She has close to 10 years of experience herself, but, you know, she's so good. And I think her performance is what carries the film.
And should we go watch this movie?
Well, let's see. I mean, I liked parts of the film. I mean, one thing, I don't think it really holds together kind of logically. You know, there's... you know, the fairy tale and how it kind of fits in with the history of this family and everything else. It ends up becoming quite complicated, and, you know, both kind of in a logical sense, but also in an emotional sense. Like, you know, the pieces don't fit together really smoothly. You have to kind of try to puzzle it out. And that, I think, takes a little bit away from the impact of the story. And so I have mixed feelings. I found it interesting, but I think it didn't have quite the impact it could have.
Jason, you saw this as well, right?
I did, yeah. I went to the premiere last week here in Seoul, and I agree with Darcy. I think, you know, in terms of the writing, it's not quite there. Mm. It's you kind of come up feeling a bit kind of like, well, it's like scratching my head. But you know, it was made on a budget of like Shippok, which
it's like 100 million. No, that's 1 billion. Is it?
Yeah, 1 billion Korean won. Right. So for that low budget and given the production values of the film, actually, I think it's quite a well made production. Mm-hmm. Maybe because of Im Soo-jung being attached, they were able to get things done cheaper, but. You know, I do think it's in terms of the production values, it's well crafted. Darcy mentioned the performances, and Im Soo-jung, you know, she's terrific, and as is Park Soo-yi as well. You know, there's something so alluring about her eyes. You know, just her acting. There is an intensity surrounding her performance. You know, with regards to a performance. And yeah, of course, the Tale of Two Sisters vibes for sure, you know, Im Soo-jung and just, you know, the house being a central location in the movie, you know, it's just, and also just I mean, it does start off like a horror film, although it does veer off somewhat differently, but mm-hmm. it's definitely not a Tale of Two Sisters, but I found it quite intriguing, if not, I mean, yes, it's flawed, but, you know, you can forgive some of its, mm-hmm. some of the writing issues.
Okay. Lastly, this is a low-budget film, as Jason nicely outlined there. It's an independent feature, but it makes strong use of genre elements in telling its story, even if it's not a full-on fantasy or horror film. Is that a trend in Korean independent cinema today, Darcy?
I do think that we're seeing more of it. You know, I mean, traditionally you have, you know, low-budget films, which most of them are kind of very realistic, and they're, you know, we'd kind of classify them as dramas. And then Korea doesn't have quite the same tradition of, like, you know, low-budget genre films as some other countries do. But I think what we're seeing a bit more of today are films that kind of blend those two together. And, you know, a movie like this, I think that, you know, the effects were necessary to telling this particular kind of story and mm-hmm. the CGI. And maybe 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been possible for a film at this budget to create effects that looked good enough to make the film work. And, you know, I mean, the effects, they're not the level of a really big, expensive film. But, you know, I think that opens up storytelling possibilities that perhaps may not have existed in the past.
We're going to move on to Jason's introduction of a film festival instead of a film. You're going to be talking about the Pusan International Fantastic Film Festival, which kicked off yesterday and which we also talked about during this show's Korea Trending segment yesterday as well. This festival has been around for 3 decades.
Yep.
And this is one of the 3 major film festivals in Korea. Jason, tell us more.
Yeah, so Korea doesn't have a shortage of festivals. You know, the Misonsen festival recently wrapped up in Seoul, and actually you can catch some of those short films on Netflix, because Netflix sponsored the festival. But, you know, there are 3 central or 3 major festivals in Korea that actually they all emerged between 96 and 2000, like many of Korea's kind of most famous directors. So mm-hmm. there's Busan, which emerged in 96, Bucheon in 97, and Jeonju in 2000. You know, and yeah, sure, they share many similarities. They all screen independent films and some commercial titles as well. But they, you know, they all stand out for different reasons too. And I think, yeah, clearly, I mean, we talked a little bit about genre films today. And one of the reasons why BIFFAN, or the Busan International Fantastic Film Festival, does stand out is because it is a genre festival. Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's one of the, what is regarded as, recognized as one of the leading genre festivals in Asia.
We did talk about this a little bit as well yesterday, but tell us about the film that opened the Busan International Fantastic Film Festival.
Well, sadly, I'm not in Bucheon right now, so I'll get there tomorrow. So I didn't see the film, but it opened with the Korean premiere of the Chinese action adventure Blades of the Guardian. So mm-hmm. Not a Korean film, but yeah, there are a number of films screening at the festival. There's 321 films that are screening from 50 countries. So that consists of 170 features, 85 shorts, 38 AI films, mm-hmm. And others too. And there's you know, dozens of world premieres. And yeah, the festival takes place. It began yesterday, the 2nd of July, and continues until the 12th.
And this year is special because it's celebrating the 30th edition.
Yeah.
And what is it doing to mark the occasion?
Well, it's inviting me and Darcy. only joking. But yeah, it's launched a 3-year project, Asian Genre Films 99, that was jointly organized by the Korean Film Archive here in Seoul. And the first chapter of this project is called Korean Genre Films 33, and it focuses on genre cinema over the past 3 decades. So there was a committee that decided on these films, 33 titles, and 10 are screening at this year's festival. And these titles are as follows. Some great Korean films here, so you can see them on the big screen in Bucheon. Christmas in August, Nowhere to Hide, Save the Green Planet, The King and the Clown, Tatsa, The High Rollers, The Good, Bad, The Weird, The Unjust, The Shameless, Train to Busan, and Extreme Job. And there's also 11 films by female directors, and 5 of those are screening this year. So The Uninvited, Princess Aurora, Shadows in the Palace, Very Ordinary Couple, and Missing.
Hmm.
And many directors will be in town. Many of these filmmakers will be in Bucheon. So it promises to be an event where there's going to be lots of talent, both, you know, from in front and behind the camera.
I think I've seen maybe 2/3 of those films that you
there
mentioned.
You go, right, Andrea. I've seen like all of them. I definitely want to get back and see them on the big screen if I possibly can.
Okay, you mentioned AI.
So
it's at the forefront of the festival, as it is everywhere these days. But how is the industry embracing it?
Well, they, I mean, this is, you know, there are those who are kind of like all in on AI. There are those who are very skeptical, like myself. But, you know, Bucheon is one of the early festivals to kind of really champion it in Korea. They've really gone all in big time. Mm. There's an AI competition called Bucheon Choice AI Films. So it's two features, 13 shorts. There's also an AI Frontier section, so another feature, more than 20 shorts. There's an AI Content Summit that includes an international conference, business meeting, exhibitions. And there's an AI Film Institute that was co-founded by Bucheon City, SPSANT, and BIFAN in 2025. I personally am quite skeptical. I see it as more of a tool. But I don't know if Darcy agrees with me on this. I do sense that some filmmakers, certainly in Hollywood, are now kind of getting behind it. Like Martin Scorsese generated headlines in June for partnering up with an AI film. So there's some big directors out there that are, you know, not necessarily championing AI, but at least they're not like, they admit to using it and they do see it as a tool going forward. I'll have to wait and see what happens.
You mentioned Blades of the Guardian, Christmas in August.
Yeah.
All the other films are, of course, very famous here. But what other films will you be looking out for at the festival?
Well, I like to see Curry Barker's Smash It Obsession, you know, that's it's generated millions of dollars in America. And that's screening in the Bucheon Choice Features section. I like to dive in and explore the discoveries. So the Korean features in the Bucheon Choice section there. So titles include Jang Jun-hyup's Killing Time and Song Hyun-bum's The Rubber. Mm. There's also a genre file section where audiences can see the latest commercial genre films from the past few months, year. So Son Jae-gun's Wild Thing, which I raved about. I had a really good time watching that movie. And you can watch that at the festival with English subtitles, I'm assuming. And there's also Sammok Gyi, Colony, Once We Were Us. So all films we talked about on the show. And there's, you know, there's actually a lot to explore at the festival this year. You know, there is a lot of Korean titles, but also a lot of non-Korean films too.
And the industry component?
Okay, so yeah, this is NAF, otherwise known as Network of Asian Fantastic Films. It's a project market launched in 2008. So this year they're showcasing 32 projects from 29 countries. And there's also going to be a France focus, which is supported by France's kind of CNC, which is the equivalent of the Korean Film Council in France. That's been supported by the France CNC, UniFrance, and the French Embassy. Basically, France and Korea are celebrating 140 years of ties. So, you know, there's lots going on there. Actually, I remember the head of the French CNC coming last year, and he made some really interesting comments about how the French industry had recovered. And he argued that it was down to holdbacks that are kind of mandatory in France. The time between a film's release in theatres and online is like several months in France. It's not really happening here. There are no laws. And so he was making the argument that this has helped France kind of with its recovery in the film industry.
Mm. Darcy, you're going to be there because it's the 30th anniversary. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I think that, as always, there are a lot of new Korean films from directors that I haven't heard of yet. I was speaking to a programmer who said that this year they had a particularly large number of films that they invited. And so I'm kind of going in blind.
It's the best way.
Yeah, just I'll try to see, you know, new movies. And, you know, at the same time, you know, another good thing about the festival is that people come from all over the world to attend the festival. So people who I know who work at other film festivals will be in Bucheon, and there'll be time to kind of catch up with them as well. So I'm looking forward to it.
We're out of time. So that's it for today's movie spotlight. We had in the studio with us, as usual, Darcy Paquette. Thank you, Darcy.
Thank you.
And Jason Betrevase. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Andrew.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back on Monday. A reminder to our listeners that Korea 24 is produced by an all-star team, starting with our fantastic editor, Daria Kim, our very calm and patient producer, Yun So-young, and our veteran leader, producer, Kim Bum-soo.
I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye.